This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News covering Gardner and the towns of Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Petersham, Templeton, Westminster, and Winchendon. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashburnham, Petersham, and Winchendon, and thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Gardner News covering the week of July 16th through July 22nd. This is Dave Russell reading with Alexandra Zapatis. Our first story, new event plaza and parking lot set to transform downtown Gardner. This is written by Stephen Landry. A long-anticipated downtown redevelopment project in Gardner is entering its final phase, with city officials expecting construction on the rear Main Street event plaza and park to wrap up by the end of August. Crews are on track to complete paving of the site by the end of July, marking a major milestone in a project that has been years in the making. Once finished, the nearly 4-acre property will transform a former industrial corridor behind Main Street into a vibrant public gathering space featuring an event plaza, green space, and extended parking. The event plaza will include an open park with benches, bike racks, shade trees, and a water feature with spray jets in the sidewalks. The city's annual food truck festival will be held at the site. The $4.1 million project is being funded through a Mass Works grant and is designed to enhance the downtown area while improving access for residents, workers, and visitors. One of the project's most significant features will be the addition of nearly 100 parking spaces. City officials say the new lot will nearly double the amount of available downtown parking, helping address a long-standing concern for businesses and visitors while supporting future growth in the city center. The development will also create a new public venue for community events and gatherings, providing Gardner with additional outdoor space for festivals, entertainment, and other activities. Another key component is the formalization of Sullivan's Alley, which will serve as a direct connection between Main Street and the new plaza. The improved corridor is expected to make it easier for people to access downtown shops, restaurants, and businesses while creating a more welcoming connection between the parking area and Main Street. The project represents the latest chapter in a redevelopment effort that began more than a decade ago. In 2015, the city started acquiring properties in the rear Main Street corridor as part of a broader plan to revitalize the area. Those efforts led to the construction of Derby Drive, which opened in 2018 and laid the groundwork for the current project. Once completed, the plaza will serve as both a functional asset and a destination for the community, providing much-needed parking while creating a flexible space for public events and downtown activities. City officials have not yet announced a date for a ribbon-cutting or grand opening ceremony, but one is expected to be scheduled after construction is complete later this summer. Our next story, Beeman's Ponds Campground Beach Closure Ongoing, Where to Swim Instead. A section of Beeman's Pond in Otter River State Forest remains closed to swimming after water quality tests detected elevated levels of bacteria, marking the second consecutive weekend the popular swimming area has faced restrictions. According to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, swimming in water with high bacteria levels can lead to illnesses ranging from nausea and vomiting to sore throats, fever, rashes, and infections. A spokesperson for the Department of Conservation and Recreation said the swimming area near the campground at Beeman's Pond was closed after routine water quality testing found bacteria levels above state standards. The closure applies only to the campground waterfront. The high levels of bacteria were due to naturally occurring factors, according to the DCR. Officials declined to offer any suggestion regarding what was causing the elevated levels at Beeman's Pond. Visitors to the Otter River State Forest still have alternatives. The DCR said the Beeman's Pond day-use beach is now open, as is nearby Lake Denison, which directly abuts the state forest. It is not uncommon for a section of a relatively small body of water to be closed to swimming while the rest is open, according to DCR officials. Beeman's Pond, for example, covers only a few acres, and the two beaches are just a few hundred yards away from each other, but contamination at one swimming area does not mean the other area is also contaminated. Bacteria do not spread evenly across a small pond, according to DCR experts. The closure is part of a standard public health protocol required under Department of Public Health regulations. DCR conducts regular water quality monitoring at all agency-managed swimming areas. Tests measure bacterial concentrations in water samples collected from beaches and waterfronts. When bacteria levels exceed acceptable limits, state regulations require officials to immediately post no swimming warnings and notify state and local boards of health. Follow-up testing is typically conducted within 24 to 48 hours to determine whether conditions have improved. If subsequent tests show bacteria levels have returned to acceptable standards, the warnings are removed and swimming can resume. The DCR said it planned to retest the campground area of Beeman's Pond on Tuesday, July 21st. Officials noted that temporary beach closures are not uncommon and can be triggered by several factors: heavy rainfall, stormwater runoff, failing septic systems, and animal waste can all contribute to sudden increases in bacteria levels. Waste from geese and other wildlife can be washed into lakes and ponds, affecting water quality. Residents looking for the latest information on the swimming area closures can check the state's interactive beach water quality dashboard, which provides updates on beach conditions across Massachusetts. Additional information about water quality testing and health risks associated with elevated bacteria levels is available through the DCR and the Massachusetts Department of Public Health websites. Haywood Healthcare is in the news, tackling child care cost barriers. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. Employees at Haywood Healthcare with the greatest financial need could soon see access to fully subsidized child care, according to a community announcement. The initiative is part of a regional effort to expand access to affordable, reliable child care in North Central Massachusetts. The United Way of North Central Massachusetts has been selected as a recipient of the Commonwealth Employer Child Care Innovation Fund, a statewide initiative announced by the Healy Driscoll administration. The funding will support a partnership between Haywood Healthcare, the Community Foundation of North Central Massachusetts, and Upwards. Haywood Healthcare will provide fully subsidized child care for employees with the greatest financial need while working with community partners to build long-term sustainable solutions. Haywood Healthcare is one of the largest employers in North Central Massachusetts and has spent years analyzing workforce challenges. Internal data reveal that child care is a leading factor impacting attendance, retention, and recruitment. The Economic Policy Institute reports that average annual cost of infant care in Massachusetts is $26,709. Access to affordable, reliable child care is one of the most significant challenges facing our workforce today, said Rosanna Penny, president and CEO of Haywood Healthcare. Too often, employees are forced to step away from the workforce because they cannot make ends meet. With an overwhelming majority of our workforce made up of women, many balancing work and family responsibilities, this is deeply personal to our organization. The initiative is supported by a matching gift from a private donor through the North Central Massachusetts Foundation and reflects more than 3 years of collaboration through the Employers and Child Care Coalition of North Central Massachusetts. Through a platform powered by Upwards, employees will be connected with licensed child care providers based on location, schedule, and availability. The program will also support placement, enrollment, and administration of tuition subsidies. Data gathered through the platform will help partners identify gaps in care and work with providers to expand services where they are needed most. Access to affordable, high-quality child care is essential to the strength of our workforce, the success of our families, and the future of our communities, said Corey Yang, President and CEO of United Way of North Central Massachusetts. Together, we are investing in solutions that expand child care capacity, support providers, and create more opportunities for children and working families throughout North Central Massachusetts. The ECCIF program is designed to test innovative models that expand access to affordable, high-quality child care while building capacity within the sector. Priority is given to initiatives that support workers in high-demand sectors such as healthcare, expand access to underserved areas, and benefit families with the greatest need. Additional details on program implementation will be shared as the initiative progresses. Now a story from South Ashburnham, former hazard, new habitat. Whitney Pond Conservation Area opens. This is written by Amelia Cardona. Once home to the W.F. Whitney Furniture Factory in South Ashburnham, the site has now become the newest conservation area in Greater Gardner. The Whitney Pond Conservation Area at 2 Gardner Road in Ashburnham opened to the public on Tuesday, July 14th, during a ceremonial ribbon cutting hosted by town officials. This project took nearly a decade and over $1.2 million in state and nonprofit grants to complete. It wasn't just about removing an unwanted old dam, but also how we could give a little more back to the community, Beth Lambert, director of the Division of Ecological Restoration, said. This project is an inspiration of how local, state, and private nonprofit partnerships can come together to accomplish a big-picture project. Along with the DER, Ashburnham Department of Public Works and Conservation Commission, the Nashua River Watershed Association helped coordinate the dam removal and construction of the recreation area where visitors can walk, sit, and observe the site's ecological restoration. Removing the dam was important not only to prevent a major hazard that could flood and damage homes downstream and Route 101, but it will also improve water quality for native species like the native eastern brook trout who live downstream, Lambert said. In 2017, during a routine inspection, the Massachusetts Dam Office categorized the Whitney Pond Dam as a significant safety hazard. There was no particular use for the dam any longer. The dam had not been used for hydropower since 1975. The Whitney Pond Dam was located on the Whitman River across Center Street at 2 Gardner Road in Ashburnham. In 2019, state funding was secured and residents of Ashburnham also approved the removal project, as the upkeep and repair of the dam would continue to cost the town millions of dollars in the years to come. Last summer, in 2025, the Whitney Pond Dam was removed, allowing fresh water to flow freely and slowly restore itself as a cold water fishery resource. While the new Ashburnham Conservation Area is finally open to visitors, the town's Rail Trail Committee is currently in the early planning stages for a project to extend the pathways at the conservation area so they connect with existing trails in the town. Susie Bresney, a Mass Division of Ecological Restoration Specialist, said that DER will also continue to monitor the natural restoration progress of the Whitman River, as cold water is now allowed to flow freely. She said that downstream, two culverts are preventing the native eastern brook trout from swimming back up to the Whitman River, so removing the culverts is another project they plan to do to continue to restore the habitat. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now Alexandra Zapantis joins us. She has more Gardner news for you. Alexandra?
Thank you, Dave. New grant brings diverse food options to Mount Wachusett Community College pantry. This is a staff report for the Gardner News. Students at Mount Wachusett Community College now have greater access to culturally relevant and medically appropriate foods through Monnie's Market, the college's on-campus food pantry. The MWCC Foundation received a $5,300 grant from the 2026 Worcester County Food Bank Fund to end hunger through the Greater Worcester Community Foundation, according to a community announcement. The grant will support the Nourishing Diversity Initiative at Monnie's Market, which aims to expand food options for students with specific dietary, medical, and religious needs. Monnie's Market serves nearly 1,100 students annually, providing free groceries and essential food resources across MWCC's Gardner and Lemonster campuses at the Automotive Technology Center. The Nourishing Diversity Initiative was developed in response to growing student demand for foods that reflect diverse cultural traditions and meet specific dietary requirements. The grant will help fund the purchase of specialty food items, including halal, kosher, gluten-free, low-sodium, allergen-friendly, and culturally significant foods that are often difficult for students to access through traditional food assistance programs. Funds will support both Monnie's Market pantry locations and community refrigerators located throughout MWCC campuses. Why does it matter? Food insecurity is about more than having enough food. It's about having access to foods that support health, culture, and well-being, said Terry Young, basic needs specialist at MWCC. This funding allows us to better serve students whose dietary needs have historically been underrepresented in food assistance programs and helps ensure that every student feels seen, respected, and supported. Recent data collected through Monnie's Market indicates that nearly 1 in 4 pantry users report cultural, medical, or allergen-related dietary restrictions. Students' feedback has consistently highlighted the need for foods that reflect their cultural identities and dietary practices. Supporting student success. Monnie's Market has become an essential resource for students, said Carla Zatoli, executive director of the MWCC Foundation. We are grateful to the Worcester County Food Bank Fund to End Hunger and the Greater Worcester Community Foundation for investing in student success through this important initiative. By providing foods that honor students' cultures and health needs, we are helping remove barriers to academic achievement and personal well-being. The Nourishing Diversity Initiative builds upon previous efforts to expand food equity and inclusion at Monnie's Market. The project aligns with the Worcester County Food Bank Fund to End Hunger's mission to increase access to healthy food and address hunger throughout Worcester County. For more information about Monnie's Market and student basic needs resources at MWCC, visit www.mwcc.edu. This story was created by Kimberly Green, K. Green, at usatodayco.com, with the assistance of artificial intelligence, AI. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Learn more at cm.usatoday.com/ethical-conduct. 750,000 anonymous donation to nonprofits strengthens Gardner's community. This is a staff report for the Gardner News. An anonymous donor has contributed $750,000 to support 16 nonprofit organizations and public agencies in North Central Massachusetts, according to a community announcement. The grants, distributed in late February and March 2026, aim to address funding gaps in healthcare, housing, food security, behavioral health, education, legal assistance, and economic opportunity. The funding comes at a time when federal and state budget cuts are putting pressure on nonprofits across the state, according to the announcement. The grants were distributed through the Community Foundation of North Central Massachusetts, which connects donors with local needs. This kind of responsive grant-making shows how a community foundation can partner with donors to quickly and effectively direct philanthropy where it can do the most good, Stephen J. Adams, president of the Community Foundation of North Central Massachusetts, said in the announcement. Healthcare and behavioral health. Haywood Hospital received $150,000 to expand its diagnostic ultrasound capacity, increasing access to critical imaging services for patients who rely on the hospital as a safety net provider. Community Health Connections was awarded $100,000 to expand behavioral health services at a time when demand for mental health care continues to rise while public funding remains uncertain. Housing and food security. Several organizations received funding to help families experiencing financial hardship. Making Opportunity Count, the Spanish American Center, and Valuing Our Children each received grants to support housing stability, food access, utility assistance, and other critical services. Opportunities for Hope received $20,000 to strengthen family shelter programming, and the City of Fitchburg received $10,000 to help sustain its homeless warming center. Growing Places was awarded $50,000 to continue its Fresh Box program, which connects residents with fresh, locally grown produce. Literacy volunteers of the Montechusett area received $20,000 to sustain adult literacy and English for speakers of other languages programming. Support for survivors and legal assistance. YWCA Central Massachusetts, Pathways for Change, and Voices of Truth received a combined $85,000 to ensure crisis intervention, advocacy, and support services remain available to survivors of domestic and sexual violence. RFK Community Alliance received $50,000 and Restoration Recovery Center received $15,000 to strengthen behavioral health and recovery services. Community Legal Aid received $20,000 to provide legal assistance to low-income residents, and the Polis Center was awarded $5,000 to support its small business incubator. A timely investment. The grants were intentionally deployed quickly to address growing funding gaps affecting essential services in the region, according to the announcement. The investment reflects the Community Foundation's role in connecting generous donors with timely community needs, allowing philanthropy to respond rapidly when circumstances change. This story was created by Kimberly Green, kgreen at usatodayco.com, with the assistance of artificial intelligence, AI. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Learn more at cm.usatoday.com/ethical-conduct. Gardner woman must repay $100,000 after decade of disability fraud. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. A Gardner woman was sentenced to one day of prison, deemed served, and 3 years of supervised release and was ordered to pay $100,080 in restitution. On Thursday, July 16th, by U.S. District Court Judge Margaret R. Guzman in federal court in Worcester. According to a statement from the Massachusetts District of the U.S. Attorney's Office, Michelle M. DeSalvo of Gardner wrongfully received Social Security disability benefits for 10 years. DeSalvo received approximately $93,640 in Social Security disability benefits, to which she was not entitled. DeSalvo was charged in February, and then, in March, she pleaded guilty to one count of receipt of stolen government money or property, one count of Social Security fraud, and one count of false statements. DeSalvo began receiving supplemental security income in 2001, a disability benefit from the Social Security Administration. Applicants are eligible for these benefits based on having limited income and resources. Married individuals' eligibility is assessed by looking at the applicant's spouse's income and resources if they live together. The applicant is required by law to notify SSA of any changes in marital status, living arrangements, and household income. In June 2014, DeSalvo reported to SSA that she was married, but lied about whether she and her husband had separated in September 2013, when they were actually living together, according to the statement. Between December 2014 and August 2023, DeSalvo told the SSA at 5 separate interviews that she did not live with her husband, which enabled her to continue to receive SSI benefits. In October 2023, DeSalvo also submitted an inaccurate lease agreement to SSA, in which she omitted her husband because she knew that if she said she lived with him, her husband's income would have made her ineligible for Social Security benefits. Eli Lev brings present journey to Red Apple Farm. This is a staff report for the Gardner News. Singer-songwriter Eli Lev will perform at the Brew Barn at Red Apple Farm in Phillipston on August 11, 2026. Lev is known for his heartfelt lyrics and melodies inspired by his travels and self-discovery, according to a community announcement. His latest project, an EP called Present Journey, reflects his experiences as a middle-aged, full-time, independent musician who embraces a mobile lifestyle. Lev's previous release, The Four Directions Project, connects different spheres and generations through uplifting and emotionally resonant music. He has opened for artists like Shooter Jennings and Lee DeWise, and has performed at venues such as the Kennedy Center and 930 Club in Washington, D.C. Lev has toured extensively across the United States and internationally, including performances in Australia, France, Israel, New Zealand, Spain, and the United Kingdom. What others are saying. Rhonda Brown said, "Eli's original, spirit-filled lyrics become familiar and make you want to join in singing, clapping, and dancing as soon as he starts singing. Sweet voice, kind soul." Jay Keating, SAW president, praised Lev's positivity and lyrical ease. Amber Foster of Last Call Entertainment called Lev a consummate professional and noted that venues continue to request his performances. The Brindley brothers, owners of venues like Jam and Java and Union Stage, highlighted Lev's professionalism and promotional efforts. Event details. Lev's performance at the Brew Barn is scheduled to start at 6 p.m. The venue is located at Red Apple Farm in Phillipston. This story was created by Kimberly Green, kgreen@usatodayco.com, with the assistance of Artificial Intelligence, AI. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Learn more at cm.usatoday.com www.ethical-conduct. And now, back over to you, Dave.
Thank you, Alexandra. Our next story, Hubbardston leaders seek state aid for town projects. This story was created by Kimberly Green with the assistance of artificial intelligence. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Now the story. Residents in Hubbardston may soon see progress on several key projects thanks to renewed attention from state and local officials. On Monday, July 13th, officials toured three sites, the municipal complex at 48 Gardner Road, the town center property at 21 Gardner Road, and the sand pit at Pitcherville Road and Gardner Road, according to a community announcement. State Senator Peter Durant, State Representative Donnie Berthume, and State Director of Rural Affairs Ann Goby joined local leaders to discuss the town's critical needs. Hubbardston Select Board Chair Katie Young emphasized the importance of state collaboration. Hubbardston is very fortunate to have such a great team of state officials working with us to build a brighter future. There is so much potential that we are working hard to achieve, but we need the help of the state, said Katie Young, chair of Hubbardston Select Board. I am grateful that Ann Goby, Senator Durant, and Representative Berthume care so much about our town. Select Board Vice Chair Peter Walker echoed the sentiment, noting the town's financial challenges. We've heard time and time again Hubbardston cannot cut its way out of our financial challenges. We need to invest our way to a brighter future, shared Hubbardston Select Board Vice Chair Peter Walker. I feel so fortunate to have a chance to see our legislative officials here, helping us build our economic and civic opportunities to raise revenues and help balance our long-range financial responsibilities, said Walker. Interim Town Administrator Sean Fitzgerald outlined three of the initiatives: municipal complex, ongoing efforts to improve the facility at 48 Gardner Road, the town center property, development plans for the site at 21 Gardner Road, and sand pit remediation. The site at Pitcherville Road and Gardner Road was scarified and destroyed years ago to help Boston's Big Dig project and now requires restoration. Hubbardston has done so much to work to advance the municipal complex, develop the town center property, and untap the potential of the sand pit, shared Interim Town Administrator Sean Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald noted that the town swapped land with the Commonwealth decades ago to advance these priorities. It has been decades since the town swapped land with the Commonwealth to help advance some town priorities, and it's now time for action. Hubbardston has critical public safety needs it needs to address, and we need broader help from our state and federal officials as we seek to advance these initiatives. The sand pit was scarified and destroyed years ago to help Boston's Big Dig project. It's time to remediate this incredible location and help build a safer and brighter future for the town of Hubbardston and the region. That, according to Fitzgerald. A story from Winchendon, aspiring food entrepreneurs gain low-cost kitchen access. This is written by Amelia Cardona. The Winchendon CAC is more than a place where families can pick up food, bowl a few frames, or grab a sandwich. It's also home to a licensed commercial kitchen that helps entrepreneurs turn culinary ideas into businesses. Since 2023, the nonprofit organization in Winchendon has rented its commercial kitchen space for as little as $10 an hour to support aspiring local entrepreneurs, not just in Greater Gardner, but across the state. Shana Cunningham, Winchendon CAC Associate Director, said they were surveying the community to better understand what people wanted access to, and many pointed out that there were no commercial kitchen spaces in the area. The closest are in Worcester. The CAC has a partnership with the Wachusett Business Incubator in Gardner. It has supported over 30 entrepreneurs through their Local Makers program, whether through the commercial kitchen or courses that provide the certification they need to start their business. Miss Judy Salsa, JP's Slush Stop, and Egg Rolls and Beyond are just three Winchendon businesses that are not only using the commercial kitchen, but collaborating with the CAC to get the support they need to push their business further. What we are consistently hearing is that there are so many talented entrepreneurs and residents, not only in Winchendon, but in all of North Central Massachusetts, who were unable to access a commercial kitchen, she said. Their kitchens themselves would not qualify to be cottage certified, so it seemed like they were kind of stuck in limbo when they had a passion, but they couldn't monetize it or bring it to the next level. Together, we're creating a stronger regional support system for our makers. We're looking toward a common goal of supporting local makers, and both coming from that nonprofit standpoint, she said. We're not thinking, what could we get from them? It's more, how can we support them, and how can we continue to grow this initiative? Anyone is allowed to rent the space. There's no need to prove that you're from Winchendon or even the greater Gardner area. Anyone can use the commercial space for $10 an hour or pay a monthly fee and become a Local Maker member. There are four tiers of Local Maker membership, ranging from $5 to $150 per month, each with access to the commercial kitchen and different benefits, from marketing support to production support. Local makers are also allowed to use the Sunshine Cafe for pop-up events, and their products are put in the point-of-sale system for sale. This is a community-inspired kitchen, and it is meant for anybody across the region to have access to a resource like this if they need it, she said. We're really able to meet them where they're at on an individual level because it really looks different for each maker. Cunningham said that while there are no requirements to rent the kitchen, a certified ServSafe manager must still be present when food is being prepared. She said that usually when an aspiring maker doesn't have a ServSafe certification, they provide them with a course to get certified. In the meantime, all Winchendon CAC staff are certified and current local makers also volunteer so that the person can use the kitchen while they are being certified. We always try to onboard and build the skill set and the capacity of each maker. But there are makers who come to us with just an idea and ask, "What do I do?" she said. We think, "How do we get them started? Let's get you in here, or we're going to pair you with someone who has these certifications." Now we turn to a business in Gardner. Five generations keep Gardner's Stasichelis appliance thriving. This is written by Stephen Landry. For more than a century after its first sale, Stasichelis Appliance and TV remains a fixture of downtown Gardner, serving generations of local families while adapting to a retail landscape that has changed dramatically since the business opened its doors. The family-owned store is celebrating its 115th anniversary in 2026, marking a milestone that traces back to March 11, 1911, when founder Frank Stasichelis recorded the first sale in a business ledger that still exists today. What exactly was sold that day remains a mystery. The first page is gone, but the store originally sold clock radios, raincoats, jewelry, and umbrellas, believe it or not, said John Stasichelis, Frank's great-grandson. There weren't a lot of appliances at that point. Today, Stasichelis Appliance and TV specializes in televisions, refrigerators, stoves, washers, and dryers, but the business began as a much different type of retail operation. The transition toward appliance sales began after World War II when Frank's son, Leo Stasichelis, returned home and helped steer the company in a new direction. Leo began to do more on the appliance side at that point, John said. said. John, along with his brother Doug and son Jonathan, represents the fourth and fifth generations of the family to own and operate the business. The store has been located at 266 Main Street since 1980 and currently employs 14 people. While surviving for 115 years is a rare accomplishment for any business, John is quick to note that Stasichella's Appliance is not Gardner's oldest company. Royal Steam is older than us. New England Woodenware is older than us, he said. But we're probably the oldest retail store, but we're not the oldest business. Longevity, John said, comes down to a straightforward philosophy that has guided the company through more than a century of economic changes, technological advances, and shifts in consumer habits. Take care of the customer, he said. You sell what you believe in, and you make sure the customer comes first. That customer-first approach has helped to build relationships that span multiple generations. Many of today's shoppers are the children, grandchildren, and even great-grandchildren of customers who once did business with Frank and Leo Stasichellis. John pointed to the Dubzinski family as one example of those long-standing connections. Everybody knows the Dubzinskis because of Coach Walt Dubzinski at Gardner High School, he said. My dad and my grandfather dealt with Walt Sr., and I've dealt with Walt and his family and then their kids. So, yeah, it's been three or four generations with some families. These relationships have remained strong even as online shopping has transformed the retail industry. While consumers can purchase nearly anything with a few clicks, John believes major appliances remain a category where customers value seeing products firsthand before making a decision. For the most part, I still believe appliances are an in-person purchase, he said. You get good pictures looking online, but you really don't understand what an appliance actually can do unless you're actually putting your hands on it. He's compared appliance shopping to buying a vehicle. While cars can technically be purchased online, most buyers still prefer to sit behind the wheel and take a test drive before committing. To celebrate the milestone anniversary, Stasichellis Appliance and TV hosted a birthday celebration on July 18th that drew hundreds of customers, friends, neighbors, and local elected officials. For a business that started with a single sale recorded in a now incomplete ledger, the anniversary served as a reminder of how far the company has come and the generations of Gardner area residents who have helped make that success possible. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now here's Alexandra.
Thank you again, Dave. Whitney Pond Dam, deemed significant hazard, removed in Ashburnham. This is by Henry Schwann with the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. In Ashburnham, a portion of Whitney Pond Dam, classified by the state as a significant hazard, was taken down because it could fail and cause severe damage downstream. The state announced the removal on July 14th, a year after the center portion was removed so the Whitman River could be restored to a natural flow. The dam was built in the 1800s, and the significant hazard classification came after a routine inspection in 2017 that showed the structure was in poor condition. Ashburnham owned the dam that hadn't been used for hydropower since 1975, and residents voted to remove it in 2018. State funds paid for the $1.4 million removal. Now that much of the dam is gone, state officials say the river has a healthier environment for native fish and wildlife. A conservation area was added. By removing an aging dam and restoring the natural environment, we have improved public safety, enhanced valuable ecological resources, and created a new conservation area that will benefit the Ashburnham community for generations, said Ashburnham Town Administrator John Coder, in a prepared statement. Massachusetts removed 15 aging and obsolete dams last year, the most by any state in the U.S., according to state officials. The $4 million removal of the Wheelwright Pond Dam in Hardwick, that state officials say is the largest dam removal project in state history, is expected to wrap up in August. Some have questioned the project, claiming it will cause flooding and massive sediment deposits in the Ware River. The state has a goal to remove 10% of the state's 3,000 dams by 2050 to reconnect habitat, cut safety risks, and achieve biodiversity goals. Contact Henry Schwann at henry.schwann@telegram.com. S-C-H-W-A-N. Follow him on X, @HenryTelegram. Worcester County Wonders, Westminster's most iconic company. This is by Sarah Barnacle with the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. In Westminster, it has become known as a staple when one orders clam chowder, a small packet of oyster crackers decorating the side of the cup or bowl. The image of the former Westminster Cracker Company in Westminster completes the New England dish. One of the beauties of the Westminster Company's success, said Joe Sirio, founder of an annual cracker festival in Westminster. No matter where you go in the country, you sit down to eat and you can look over and chances are you'll see someone eating a bag of Westminster crackers. The somewhat iconic crackers are now nearly two centuries old, and while they are no longer made in Westminster, their recipe remains the same as they emerge from the company's location in Rutland, Vermont. Established in 1828, what began as a family recipe has grown into a nationwide name. The dough is slow-proofed for 16 hours, which gives it flavor and texture, made on some of the same vintage machines used in the earliest days of the kitchen. My great-great-grandfather bought the business around 1899, said Keith Dunn, former co-owner of the company, adding he was related to George Dolly on his mother's side. The company remained in the Dolly family for nearly two centuries. In the beginning, the factory was powered by a horse on a treadmill before modernizing to steam, and by 1922, electricity. The company produced three different types of crackers, including common, butter, and the oyster cracker. I started working there in high school, Dunn continued, but it was also around this time that they stopped making crackers altogether and switched to meal and crumbs. In the 1960s and 1970s, nearly every TV dinner produced in the country used Westminster cracker meal or crumbs in some way, including the breading of fish. The meal was used as a base for the noodles inside Lipton's cup of soups. The crumb industry surpassed the need for crackers, he said. In 1980, the company was sold by the Dolly family to Pillsbury, but as Dunn said, it was short-lived. By 1988, Peter Dolly retained the rights to the company and decided to breathe new life into the iconic cracker. He was living in Vermont at the time and called me and said, "I'm thinking of resurrecting the cracker. Would you be interested?" Our first sale was in 1990, and the rest is history, Dunn said. The pair essentially restarted the company from scratch with nothing more than the recipe and grew the company over the next two decades to once again be the top-selling oyster cracker to the nation's restaurant industry until the sale of the company in November 2009. We had no equipment, Dunn said with a chuckle. We had to ask our friends for funding, but everyone kept telling us they missed the crackers, so we just kept going. We did have one thing going for us. The Thomas L. Green Company had put in an automated line in town years prior, and the engineer was still around, so that worked in our benefit. We ended up getting an old cracker cutting machine from Hilo, Hawaii. They were just going to throw it into the ocean. We literally started out in Vermont using the same equipment that was used in the 1800s. Back in Westminster, the original factory building still stands at the center of town. According to the town of Westminster, the factory was the longest-running bakery in the country for nearly a century before its sale and ultimate relocation. Many in Westminster and its surrounding communities remember the factory well, including the smell of baking crackers as residents passed by. In its heyday, when I was a kid, Dunn said, anyone who would walk to school would stop in and get their fill of crackers from large barrels. Sometimes they'd be snacks, sometimes they'd become little weapons thrown by the kids. But again, by at least 1968, we simply weren't making crackers anymore. Since 2015, the crackers are celebrated at the annual Cracker Festival with live music, games, food, and yes, plenty of crackers. The event typically takes place on the third Saturday of October and sees some 60,000 attendees, including Dunn and his wife. The concept for the festival really began in 2008 while sitting at the kitchen table, Sirio said. We were thinking about a festival for the community, but we didn't have a theme. The idea came from my partner, Debbie. After all, the crackers are the most iconic thing in our town. The festival didn't take shape for another several years, Sirio said, adding it was in 2014 when Westminster made national news as the town became the first in the nation to propose banning the sale of tobacco products. While the Board of Health argued the industry's ever-changing products, specifically designed to entice young people, needed to be thwarted, local business owners pushed back and said the ban would cause losses and profit of up to $20,000 annually. Sirio joined the fight, taking the side of the local small businesses, and began planning a small concert in town to garner support. However, before the event could take place, the Board of Health changed its mind, leaving the proposed ban on the cutting room floor. Instead of canceling the event, Sirio said the community gathered and celebrated the so-called victory. We had a band, and I made an announcement telling the crowd that a year from today, we would host our first ever Westminster Cracker Festival, he said with a laugh. The festival has been thriving for a decade now, only missing one year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Thousands from both the region and beyond come every year, he said. It's really becoming a homecoming event for those who no longer live in the area, but come back to visit. For Sirio, one of the highlights includes a chili contest, complete with a $1,000 grand prize for the winner. As for the crackers, he describes himself as a contrarian when it comes to New England tastes and opts for tomato-based Manhattan clam chowder with his crackers. Dunn said he prefers to eat the crackers plain and never puts them in his chowder, always simply eating them as a side dish. For others around the nation, Dunn said he remembers receiving thousands of letters, many from expectant mothers and cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy, all proclaiming the Westminster oyster crackers are the only thing they're able to keep down as they battle morning sickness and radiation, respectively. Outside of the festival, the organization also hosts a year-round contest called Westminster Crackers Are Everywhere. The public is encouraged to share photos of their Westminster crackers from across the country on the Westminster Festival Facebook page. The annual winner receives a $100 prize. Last year, the winner posted from Alaska. From Westminster to the West Coast, it remains clear the oyster crackers' legacy is a delicious one. One that without Peter Dolly and Keith Dunn would have died more than 40 years ago. I always say, I wouldn't trade the experience for anything, but I wouldn't do it again, Dunn said with a laugh. TNG engagement editor Sarah Barnacle is getting to know Central Mass by exploring some of the best places to go and things to do in Worcester County. If you have an idea or suggestion, please email sbarnacle at Sbarnacle@gannett.com. Sbarnacle@gannett.com. I am now going to read an excerpt from the following story. Cost of living and housing driving out some mass residents, poll says. This is by Margie Cullen with the USA Today Network, New England. 3 in 10 Massachusetts residents say they want to leave Massachusetts, and 1/3 say they are likely to leave the state within the next 5 years, according to a new poll from the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. The poll, released July 7th, found the potential flight is largely due to the cost of living and housing. The poll follows census data that showed more people have been moving out of Massachusetts in recent years. The state experienced a net loss of 33,340 people from 2024 to 2025 and 19,000 people the year before. The poll surveyed 709 Massachusetts residents online from June 18th through the 23rd. It has an error of margin of 3.7%. Why do Mass residents want to leave? According to the poll, 29% of Bay Staters definitely or probably want to move out of Massachusetts. A slightly higher amount, 34%, say they are likely to leave the state in the next 5 years. Of those who are likely to move out, 70% say that cheaper housing or cost of living is an important reason for them to leave. A little over half cite a desire for lower taxes, and 39% say they want a different political or social environment. Housing is a major issue in Massachusetts. A June 30th poll from the University of New Hampshire Survey Center found a majority of Massachusetts residents believe housing or the cost of living is the most important problem facing the state. Affordability is also a concern. In the poll, only 15% of Bay Staters overall described the state as an affordable place to live, while 85% said it was not affordable. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Alexandra Zapantis. Thank you for listening.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Professor Puzzler posed a problem to his plastered pub pals. What are the last few hairs on a dog's tail called?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The last few hairs on a dog's tail are called dog hairs. Of course.
And now back to our regular programming.
Are you or a loved one experiencing vision loss? Unable to read your daily newspapers? Feeling isolated because of blindness? If the answer is yes, Audio Journal can help. Live broadcasts of newspapers and other local publications enable blind, visually impaired, and print-disabled residents of Worcester County to connect with their communities. Newspaper readings, informative programming, education, and entertainment return you to the printed word your vision loss has denied you. For information about Audio Journal's free service, call 508-797-1117. Again, the number is 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org or go to our website at www.audiojournal.org. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.